This podcast exists because of our supporters at DecodingTV.com. Head over to DecodingTV.com to sign up to receive ad-free episodes and exclusive bonus episodes that Kim Renfro and I will record just for members. Thanks to everyone who makes the show possible.
You've come for the egg.
Here it is.
Are you mad? You'd never survive this.
Well, happily, neither would you.
To choose violence here is to declare war against your king.
Wonderful.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to A Cast of Kings, a Decoding TV recap podcast about the HBO original series House of the Dragon. I'm David Chen, and I haven't read Fire and Blood, the book on which House of the Dragon is based.
And I'm Kim Renfro, and I have read Fire and Blood, the book upon which House of the Dragon is based.
Welcome to the show, everyone. Every week on this podcast, we recap this week's episode of House of the Dragon. This week, we'll be recapping Season 1, Episode 2, The Rogue Prince. We will not be spoiling anything from future episodes. That includes anything from the book, Fire and Blood. That also includes anything on the next time on preview that you can see on House of the Dragon on HBO. So please be aware of our spoiler policy. We really appreciate that. You can find more episodes of the show at acastofkings.com. Email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. You can find this podcast on YouTube at acastofkings.com/YouTube and on TikTok at acastofkings.com/TikTok. Last week, Kim Renfro, I said, hey, here's a pro tip. If you don't want to be spoiled, do not Google anyone's name in the show. Mm-hmm. Do not Google any character names because you will get hit with spoilers so instant, your eye will be unable to avert them. Well, I have a minor addition to that mantra for you, which is if you don't want to be spoiled, don't Google anyone's name from the show, and also don't start a TikTok account based off of the podcast, The Cast of Kings. We basically launched our TikTok account in earnest last week, made a bunch of posts. Our TikToks have gotten over 1 million views in the last week. So if you are here from the TikTok page, like probably a lot of people saw that the TikToks that we made together, and I saw a lot of comments saying like, wow, I didn't know you guys existed. And so there's probably a bunch more listeners this week from TikTok. Welcome.
Welcome.
Please be aware we don't spoil anything from future episodes. And also people just dropping spoilers left and right in those TikTok comments that I had to delete, unfortunately. So
brutal.
There are some major developments that I am now aware of. However, I will keep them under my hat as
best. Yeah, I don't even know what you know now. This is great.
Yes.
Shield of mystery.
And I have not told you because I, A, don't wish it to be confirmed, and B, maybe the show's going to change it up. You don't know, right?
Yeah.
It's very possible the show might change some things up. So I'm still holding out hope that I haven't been spoiled, Kim. Okay. What else? We got a couple of other announcements and some emails to go over before we get to our recap of Season 1, Episode 2. I do have a major announcement about House of the Dragon, which is that it's been renewed for Season 2 already.
Woohoo.
We talked last week in the bonus episode, Kim Renfro, about how House of the Dragon is HBO's biggest premiere, you know, in terms of ratings ever, right? Like, they have not had a higher premiere or more popular premiere. So that was pretty notable in and of itself, and it shows that this show has potential staying power, and obviously Warner Brothers Discovery has a lot invested in making sure that this thing continues to spit out more seasons and more spinoffs for many years to come. So how do you feel about the House of the Dragon Season 2? Kim, are you excited?
Yeah, I was excited to see that that happened so quickly. I was not expecting them to renew it after just one episode, but clearly enough people came back. And I think that we talked about too that, like, I mean, viewing specific numbers aside, I think like the general vibe around the fandom was like an almost instant revival of the classic Game of Thrones days. So I'm excited that this means that we get to do this for so much longer.
I think the vibe I've seen in terms of memes and such is begrudging reacceptance.
Uh-huh.
That's kind of what a lot of people felt burned by Game of Thrones Season 8, and they're like, okay, I guess you've sucked me back in, you know, like, but not necessarily in like a bitter way, just like, all right, I'm back on board again, you know. But you and I also talked in the pre-episodes, like before the season began, about how there was probably like some kind of red phone where they're waiting for the ratings to come in and then they just make the call real quick. And that's probably what happened here. So,
yeah.
But yeah. And I am hoping that this new version of A Cast of Kings will last long into the future. I do want to ask that if you are a fan of this podcast, that you consider supporting Decoding TV to keep this podcast going. If 5% of the listeners of this podcast, 5% of you listening right now, supported the show at decodingtv.com, this podcast could last forever. I'd figure out a way to make it go forever. We'd have to find other things to talk about, you know? But I am hoping that people will consider supporting us and making sure the podcast lasts as long as however many Game of Thrones spinoffs HBO might have in store. So again, that's decodingtv.com where you can sign up to support us. I also have one other announcement about Decoding TV, which is there is a Decoding TV official podcast, and that podcast will be covering The Rings of Power.
Woohoo.
And we're going to be recording our first episode this week. I have a co-host for that show that I'm extremely excited about, and you're going to have to tune into Decoding TV to find it, to learn who it is. But you can find that at podcast.decodingtv.com. I'll leave a link to the show notes.
Such a tease.
I have this thing, Kim, where I don't like to announce that I'm working with a person until basically that collaboration is either in the process of happening or it is complete. Because sure. There's been too many times in the film cast's history where it's like, oh, you're going to have a guest on the show this week. And then I'll like... This is years ago, like a decade ago, you know, I would like, and I was like, oh, I'm excited that so-and-so, and then like, it doesn't work out. And then I look like a complete moron. even though we've already committed to working together for the duration of Rings of Power, I am not announcing who it is yet, but check it out at podcast.decodingtv.com. And you will learn who, and it's going to be an awesome co-host and I'm very excited about it. So
yeah. Okay. Super exciting.
Yes, Kim knows who it is, and she's not going to say. She's keeping it under her hat like spoilers for the rest of House of Dragons. So, all right, Kim, before we get to this episode, we got some emails to cover, and why don't we start actually with a comment at decodingtv.com. That's one of the things that you can do when you're a member, is you can comment at decodingtv.com. Vincent writes... Vincent comments, I'm only 10 minutes into this episode, talking about last week's episode, but I couldn't help but think of George R.R. Martin's recent comments about wishing there were more seasons of the original show. It leaves such a bad taste in my mouth for him to say that now, and I hope the show distances itself from him in general. Hope you guys talk about that at some point. And then I responded, I don't know what you're talking about, Vincent. And he says, quote, my understanding is that when Game of Thrones, the show, was first being made, it was George R.R. Martin who demanded that one season equals one book, with the shared or implicit or explicit knowledge that he would have enough time to at least get one other book out, if not the rest of the books, by the time the show caught up. Obviously, that didn't happen. And now that the show has been over and the world has collectively roasted Weiss and Benioff for so long, it just feels like Martin is switching sides and putting more blame on HBO and the showrunners when he's at least partially responsible for how things turned out. He's made little to no progress on getting the rest of the books out, so for him to retroactively act like the show did his books a disservice by not having enough seasons is pretty unfair, in my opinion. That's just my two cents based on what I know. Maybe my understanding of show politics is wrong. I'm also speaking purely as a fan of the original show, having never read the books, end quote. So, Kim, I thought I'd ask you, like, you have knowledge and experience of, like, how George R. R. Martin is being associated with the show and how he's talking about this new show. I guess I wanted to get your take on what you thought of Vincent's characterization and just your thoughts on this topic in general.
Yeah, I don't think that is an entirely correct summary of kind of how everything went down. My understanding is that there was no like explicit or even like implicit agreement that one book would equal one season of the show. I think my understanding is that, you know, George met up with Benioff and Weiss in, I want to say 2008, 2009. And yeah, his books were unfinished when they made the agreement, but he sold those rights over to HBO and handed off this show to Benioff and Weiss. And while like they were more than happy to continue having meetings with him, invite him for like cameos, he was writing one script per season. He really didn't have any like clear creative control over the decisions that were being made. So I think that there's a lot more nuance to the conversation than people usually tend to give it. My understanding is that, like, as time went on and George was not finishing The Winds of Winter, it became pretty clear that the show was catching up to his written material faster than he thought it would. Like, I know he was a little bit taken off guard by, like, the sort of combining of certain storylines or completely eliminating other characters. Like, Lady Stoneheart is a pretty, like, famous example of that. That's Catelyn Stark, who resurfaces in the books and just never did on the show. And, like, little things like that, I know that he was he didn't realize that they were going to sort of, like, streamline everything the way that they did. And then everything just became super complicated when he realized, like, okay, I need to really focus on these books. He still hasn't finished the books. And then Benioff and Weiss, you know, started kind of, like, making up their own ending because they had to, because George didn't have, the full detailed roadmap laid out. And so with House of the Dragon, it's like, I understand people might feel however they feel about the way that George is now sort of being a little bit more open about, like, what his expectations had been and how that didn't quite ever align with Game of Thrones. And now with House of the Dragon, he's way more involved. He isn't writing scripts for this show, but he seems to have a much more, like, direct relationship with Ryan Condal, who's the co-showrunner, who's more in charge of all the writing. He wrote this episode. He wrote the pilot. So yeah, I don't know. People can feel however they want to feel about George. I'm not here to tell anybody that. But I also just tend to have a lot more empathy for everybody involved, because, like, what was supposed to be an adaptation of a finished book series wound up being an adaptation of a very unfinished book series. And that obviously brought up a lot of negativity for, like, everybody involved. Benioff and Weiss themselves also didn't sign up to make up their own ending of the show. They thought that George would have the books finished by the time they got there. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. And I think I'm very torn about my feelings on the final season of Game of Thrones. On the one hand, I thought it was catastrophic, you know, from a plot and storytelling perspective. That's my opinion. I know you don't share it.
That's fine.
On the other hand, I think that if you watch the documentary of the making of the final season, I don't remember what it's called, but it's available on HBO. They made, like, a 60 to 90 minute documentary. It's really well done.
Yeah.
And one of the things that is very clear from that documentary is how much freaking work that final season took, because there was, like, multiple episodes of just, like, the whole episode is a massive set piece, right? Like,
yeah,
multiple episodes in which that happened. And you get a sense, like, these people are done. Like, they have given their all for the show. They can't do any more for the show. And physically, you sense, like, how physically exhausting it was to make the show.
Yeah.
And so even though I think as a consumer, I'm like, oh, I wish there were, you know, double the number of episodes so they could, like, resolve these points in a satisfactory way. As a human being, and as somebody who is tangentially connected to and knowledgeable about the industry, I felt like, wow, they probably gave us the best they could, and that's all we can expect, you know? So
yeah.
I'm very torn about it. So
yeah, and I would just say,
but one thing is clear is that, yeah, that George R. R. Martin is really involved with House of the Dragon, and, like, that will be that seems like it's going to continue for a while, is my sense.
Yeah, it sort of feels like he, over the course of Game of Thrones happening and unfolding the way that it did, it's like he learned a lot of lessons about his, it seems like he learned lessons about his preference of how much creative control and input he has over a property that is adapted from his work. And so he's approaching House of the Dragon differently than he did with Game of Thrones, because now he knows how hands-on he would like to be versus not from the very outset.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for that comment, Vincent. Lots to think about there. I wanted to read an email from Chris, who writes into acastofkings@gmail.com. This is an excerpt from Chris's email. He says, quote, "I really bumped on the melee." First of all, pause. I didn't really understand that phrase. I really bumped on the melee, because it sounds like Chris is not a fan, but I've never heard that terminology before. I don't know if that's what the kids are saying these days, Kim. But anyway, or maybe it's
I have no idea.
I don't know. Anyway, Chris writes, "I really bumped on the melee, the tournament. As a storytelling device, I think the whole segment kind of worked, with Rhaenys noting the pent-up aggression from years of peace and the cross-cutting with Emma's labor scene, returning to her comment earlier in the episode about how men and women have different battlefields. However, this kind of brutal melee seems like a terrible way to maintain political stability. It is one thing to see your son or nephew unhorsed in a joust or yield in one-on-one combat. It is another thing to have his face exploded by a morning star. I would expect noblemen to come up with something that doesn't result in multiple grisly deaths that will only serve to create generations-long blood feuds. And honestly, I think they could have done both scenes with less gore. My wife made us jump through the whole thing because it was so terrible. I think it is possible to communicate the horrors without actually showing them so graphically, end quote. That thought had occurred to me as well, of like, wow, if these, if Hightower's son might die in this, you know, it feels like this tournament is actually creating more problems than it's solving, you know?
Yeah, so. I that's a fair point. I think it's interesting. I saw someone point out the difference between King Robert overseeing the tourney in season one of Game of Thrones versus King Viserys. Because in Game of Thrones, when a tourney turned violent, I believe it's the Mountain, right, started attacking Loras, Sir Loras Tyrell, mm-hmm. and then, like, the Hound had to step in, and they were fighting, and it seemed like this was going to be a fight to the death, and, like, King Robert kind of stands up and is like, in the name of your king, stop. And when that sort of violence devolved in this House of the Dragon episode, nobody's, like, objecting to it. A lot of people mm-hmm. seem kind of horrified or entertained by what's going on, but it doesn't seem to be, like, against the rules. And so I'm like, maybe that's just a difference between Targaryen rule versus, like, King Robert's rule, or maybe it's just a continuity error of how appropriate it is to murder a fellow nobleman in the middle of a joust. But
yeah, either way, poorly planned, Kim. Poorly planned, I think, is what the take home is.
Sure.
Let's do a couple of follow-ups from last week's episode, specifically of A Cast of Kings and of House of the Dragon. Nick Jacobson writes in, quote, "My wife gave birth to our first child recently and she had a C-section. She really disliked most of her pregnancy and was definitely nervous about having the C-section. She was legitimately triggered by the birth scene in the show, and she's a physician, so it wasn't the gore that was the problem. Even though the show's perspective is that decision made by Viserys was a very bad one, it still concerns me when male showrunners put their female characters through such agony for plot purposes or as a character moment for male characters. Certainly not an unforgivable mistake, but I hope they have a diverse writer's room and are listening and considering everyone's perspectives." I don't know what you thought of this, Kim. I read this interview with them about the showrunners about the scene. This is a show that is made by men, largely about women. And mm-hmm. I think that is important to just keep in mind. They discussed the scene and wanting it to be extremely brutal. And they also said they showed it to as many women as possible to see if they could get their take on it and make sure that they were doing the right thing. And obviously they arrived at what they did. But just curious if
that
you had any other
reason to go off.
Yes. There you go.
I'm like, I recognize that quote. I did that. Yeah, no, it is true that at the end of the day, this is still a TV show that is based on a book written by a man and has two male showrunners. They do have more women in the writer's room than we had with the first season of Game of Thrones, I believe, as well as a couple of women directors who directed upcoming episodes. So yeah, I agree that you don't want to see some brutality against women for the sake of, I guess, like, plot devices or for male characters. I would push back on that point a little bit to say that I don't think that that scene was simply there to move Viserys' story forward. I think it's like Emma's death is like the emotional, it's like the ground floor of all of the emotions that we're going to be seeing from Rhaenyra, from Alicent, even like, I think that it has ripple effects across the entire family, not just Viserys. And I think that the fact that Viserys made the choice that he did, which Miguel Sapochnik described as, quote, effectively murdered, unquote, his wife in that scene, I think that it's there to serve as, like, the platform for why we might see characters like Rhaenyra and Alicent wary of childbirth or wary of their role, because they know firsthand how wrong everything can go. And even, like, not to jump ahead into our episode conversation, but even in this episode, Missarya also kind of brings up, like, it's like every woman character in the show is very aware of the dangers of childbirth to their own health and to their own life. And so it's not, I don't think
not only childbirth, but
there.
Like not only childbirth, but carrying a child that
the pregnancy
might be valuable
itself.
To people. Right.
Right.
That would, like, it would make them a target theoretically, you know, which is obviously something that Missaria. Yeah.
And it sets the stage for the fact that in this period of Westerosi society that George R. R. Martin has created, women are generally treated as carrying vessels for the royal bloodline and not as they're not treated as legitimate possible political players or legitimate possible rulers or people worthy of their own independent wishes. You know, Rhaenyra says she just wants to fly off somewhere with Alicent and eat cake in the first episode. And then it quickly becomes obvious that that's not a thing that young girls get to do when they grow up in this society. So
instead, they fly off with their stepmoms. No, I'm just joking. Anyway, one final thing before we get to this week's episode. Last week, we were like, what do those stone balls mean, right? And we were like, is it just like punching in? Is it kind of, you know, like the speaking stick, the conch? And turns out, that's basically it. In an interview with Hollywood Reporter, showrunner Ryan Condal says, quote, "Everybody shows up for work and they punch in. I thought it was really cool. It's a way of visualizing the set formality of the small council chamber. It's enjoyable. We should have things like that in this world," end quote. So even though they dedicated quite a bit of attention to it, I felt, and also it was in the trailer, like the stone ball was in the trailer.
Yeah.
It's decorative. And I'm just going to go out and say I didn't like the rules with the stone ball. Like, if it's punching in, shouldn't Matt Smith need to take his stone ball with him when he leaves? But he didn't do that. So I'm like, what was the point of all that? Anyway.
To show he's a bad employee who flouts corporate
policy. He leaves himself punched in even when he's punched out, basically.
Yeah,
kind of
he's getting overtime. For no work.
All right. Well, those are all the follow-ups that we wanted to mention from last week's episode. All right, Kim Renfro, let's dive into season one, episode two of House of the Dragon, entitled The Rogue Prince. We're going to spoil everything through this week's episode, nothing from future weeks. Let's start with the opening title sequence, which is a new title sequence that everyone saw for the first time this week. Like, even press didn't see the title sequence in advance. It wasn't either wasn't done or they didn't want to put it in there. What did you think of the new title sequence? Well, and actually, you know, let's start by explaining what actually goes on, right, in the title sequence. So, Kim, why don't you take it away?
Yeah, I was, when I first saw it, I was excited. I was like, ooh, what's going on? And then I got to be like, wait, what's going on? I was like, wait, what are all these things? It seems to be, it's like the camera is moving through a model of old Valyria, which we now know that is what King Viserys is having built in his chambers. That little like model city is Valyria. And so this opening credits takes us through the Targaryen line of succession. That's why like there's like blood flowing that begins in Valyria with the Doom, which we've talked about in like a bonus episode, but that's this like cataclysmic event that happened in Valyria, which was this old grand city full of dragons and magic. And then everything went terribly wrong. And the Targaryens are one of the only families that managed to escape Valyria before the Doom happened. So they are like the surviving dragon riders. So the blood kind of pours from that. And then it kind of hits all of these different little circles that have either like sigils or little outlines of the crowns that various rulers had, which is how you can identify sort of like which person is supposed to be which. So we see like Aegon the Conqueror's crown, and then like that eventually, that blood eventually runs all the way down to King Viserys, who we now know is in the show. And then it kind of ping-pongs around. I think that we see a little bit of an indication of Daemon Targaryen, who's his brother, so obviously like shares the bloodline, and then eventually ends with Rhaenyra's symbol, which is that sort of like three overlapping rings. That's the symbol that's on the necklace that Daemon gave Rhaenyra in the first episode. So we're ending right now, the opening credits are landing on her as like the next heir apparent to the Iron Throne.
But will they always land on her? Open question, right? So we'll see. But what did you think of the opening credits? Like, did you enjoy them? Obviously, it reuses the original Game of Thrones theme by Ramin Djawadi. Overall thoughts on that?
Yeah, I wasn't sure. I didn't really have expectations about whether they were going to do new music or not. I don't mind that it's the same music. I kind of like that it gives you that same feeling again. It's obviously been ages since I've heard that iconic HBO static fuzz and then cut into, na, 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 you know. I think everybody has some sort of like emotional connection with that. So I kind of get why they did that. At the same time, I think I would have loved to hear like a more Targaryen focused theme music. But overall, I liked it. What did you think?
Was not a fan.
Not a fan.
The original opening of Game of Thrones is the opening credits of Game of Thrones is like one of the, if not the greatest opening credit sequence of all time. The music is badass. The visuals are badass. It's informative. Like it actually teaches you about the world and often about the world that you're going to witness during the course of that episode. It was incredible. It's just like you get your mood instantly changes when you watch the original Game of Thrones opening theme. I don't love that they use the original theme song. To be fair, Ramin Djawadi wrote one of the greatest themes of all time. So he's like, okay, I cannot improve on this, sir.
Sure.
And that's fine. Like I understand that, but it was written for that other theme sequence, that title sequence, you know, and
yeah.
It feels very ill-fitting to this one that's honestly more gory, icky, and literal, which is like, it's blood. That's like Bloodline. You know, the blood is Bloodlines. And it's like, okay, like, whatever. It's not going to I'm probably not going to think about it after this week. And actually, that's a problem, in my opinion, because I thought about the Game of Thrones title sequence like every week. I was like, this is amazing. I love being in this world and watching this title sequence. And like this one, I'm like, first of all, the blood just kind of makes me feel icky. And I'm just like, okay, like, and it's symbolizing Bloodline. It's like, I get it, you know, like that's one of the great things about the original Game of Thrones title sequence too, was like, it felt a lot more metaphorical. It's like this elaborate game board that is like,
yeah.
You see the gears turning and coming on. And yes, you see that with this title sequence as well, but it's also just much more literal with the blood. You know what I mean?
Sure. So. And I agree that the Game of Thrones title sequence was genuinely helpful. Like it orients you in Westeros and then over to Essos, that you introduce, like they would introduce new locations in the title sequence right before they actually got introduced in a new episode. It was like, it was genuinely helpful. Whereas right now, as it stands with this, it's like, I haven't even fully broken down every single one because I was like, I need to like study the book drawings and compare crowns and like it's moving pretty quickly. So like you don't really get to like settle on like seeing what anything means. So it doesn't feel as informative. It feels a little bit more mysterious, which I think is maybe to their detriment.
Yeah. I mean, you are listening to a podcast right now that has one of the top Game of Thrones experts in the country, in my opinion, and some guy. And she doesn't know what is going on with the opening title sequence exactly. So
I mean,
like,
I know what's going on. I just need a little, I need more time, David. I need to get to some sleep.
I'm not trying to impugn your ability. I'm just saying like, it wasn't like immediately obvious to you. And, or maybe it was, but I'm like, the details weren't immediately obvious to you. And,
and I think for a normal viewer,
yeah, and for a normal viewer, it's just like completely baffling what is going on.
Right.
We should point out that there is a Twitter. Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, it seems like they know that someone else like me is going to do the job of screenshotting everything and explaining it to you. So stay tuned.
They're offloading the labor, the emotional labor of knowing the title sequence onto Kim Renfro, which is, on the
one
hand.
It's my burden to bear.
Yeah. On the one hand, they picked the right person to bear that. On the other hand, how dare they? There is a user on Twitter named Conqueror's Crown, which we'll link to in the show notes. Username like at Conqueror's Crown. Username Corlys Velaryon is black. Deal with it, which is great. they've kind of put together kind of a translation of the entire opening credit sequence. We'll link to it in the show notes, but you can check it out there. Okay, new opening title sequence. That's our discussion about that. Kim Renfro, overall thoughts on season 1, episode 2, like just the whole episode.
I love this episode. I love it. I wasn't sure where like they were going to go after that pilot. They, you know, did a lot of groundwork. I liked the pilot a lot. I thought it did a good job of kind of like setting up everything, which is the job of a pilot. So with episode two, it was like, oh, I get to see sort of like what they really want to sink their teeth into. And it just seems so obvious to me from this episode that they are really paying attention to the women's perspective, to like all of these girls' perspective. And I think doing a very good job of just like showing exactly how many obstacles every woman in Westeros is sort of up against when it comes to claiming any sort of power for themselves. And so I loved it. I thought all the performances were great. I love that Dragonstone sort of like set piece. Really cool new music cues for Rhaenyra. So yeah, overall, I thought it was a really awesome second episode for this series. What'd you think?
I thought it was pretty good. Some really amazing, breathtaking sequences throughout, and really enjoyed the new Dragonstone. Like, it looks so cool, and the reveal is so cool, and like, it's just the CG looks amazing. So I love that old stuff. Loving Rhaenyra, the actress Millie Alcock who plays her, like, just loving that character. And honestly, I told you I enjoyed her so much that I'm kind of bummed, because we know there's a time jump that's going to happen at some point. We're going to see an older version of her, and so I think our time with this character at this age with this actress is limited. And but she is like probably the most compelling character on screen in my opinion, and kind of the beating heart of the series at this point. Go ahead.
When we talked last week about episode one, you had said that like it didn't quite, you couldn't quite feel that there was like one single protagonist yet. Did that change at all for this episode with you and like with Rhaenyra in particular?
Yeah,
I kind of think that she's the.
I agree. She becomes like much more clearly the focus. And we should point out, by the way, that like, this episode tells like a fairly linear story. You know, it's, and that linear story, by the way, is. Which underage woman is, or which underage girl is the king going to marry? And so, and so that's kind of why
tale.
I was like, yeah, like, that old chestnut. And, you know, that's kind of why I was like, okay, like, how invested am I in, like, which one of these? He's either going to make a choice that's horrifying or one that's slightly less horrifying and also has terrible implications for his daughter. These are the two choices. And it's like, not really loving either, like, not really feeling like I, you know, am invested in either one of these decisions, because they both seem pretty bad, you know. And so for that reason, the dramatic tension of the episode didn't really work for me, because it's like, these are both horrible. Like, I don't, it's one thing if he's like needs to choose a good thing and then like has many reasons to not choose the right decision and then he makes the right decision. Like, that would be classic story, but he's choosing between two fairly bad things, and it's like, okay, like, you know, not much whatever happens, he's gonna make a bad choice. So but you know, on the plus side, as my wife said after we watched the episode, big episode for flesh wounds. So if you're a flesh wound fan, you're gonna really like season one, episode two. No, many good things about it. Let's talk about it. Okay, we see throughout the course of this episode many scenes of the crab feeder, lots of graphic images of the crab feeder doing his thing. I just love that, like, Game of Thrones knows, or House of the Dragon in this case, knows the right details to show you to make sure you are properly grossed out, right? In the case of the crab feeder, they show like a crab crawling into a guy's foot, and then the foot starts moving, so you know the person's alive. It's like truly horrifying.
Yeah.
Anyway. Remind us who the crab feeder is, right? He is threatening the who is the crab feeder, and what does the crab feeder want, and why is he a threat to Viserys?
Yeah, so he's the crab feeder is kind of like the current leader of this group of unified folks. They kind of call themselves the Triarchy, is how Corlys Velaryon refers to them. So it's three different regions of Essos, which is like, you know, not too far away from Westeros. Like, you can get a ship between either continent pretty quickly. And so he's been attacking a certain part of Westeros that Corlys is very defensive of, and that is directly affects all of like the shipping trade routes and stuff. And so it's sort of like, it's not a war, as we learn, like Viserys is like very directly trying not to engage with the crab feeder to like ignite a larger war. But as we see, like people are dying, Westerosi men are dying and being tortured in this very terrible way. And Lord Corlys wants to do something about it, as he should.
And Viserys is like not intervening in the way that Corlys wants, right?
Right. And like, and Otto's like, oh, we'll send money to their families. And it's like, you get the sense of how like some, like that there's a certain ruling class in Westeros that doesn't quite value individual human life, because they're like, oh, this would just lead to like another thing that we don't really want to deal with. Whereas Corlys, I think that you see that like he cares very directly that people are actively being tortured and murdered by this guy on Westerosi land, and he wants to do something about it, which I get.
Agreed. Corlys comes off as fairly reasonable overall in this episode, other than the part where he's trying to marry off his like 12-year-old daughter. But anyway.
Yeah, we'll get to that.
There's a scene with Viserys and Rhaenyra at the small council. It emerges, first of all, that, like there has been a 6-month time jump since last episode, which kind of sent my mind reeling a little bit. Because everyone looks the same, you know, like there's all the actors are the same, and but it's like there's a 6-month time jump. A lot has happened in that time. We just talked about the Triarchy and all the associated things about that. But Daemon has been at Dragonstone for over half a year and is fortifying it against the will of the king and kind of obviously engaging in seditious behavior. Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, yeah, because at the end of episode one, Viserys kind of like throws the gauntlet down and banishes him from King's Landing and tells him to go back to his wife who lives near the Vale. And clearly we learn in this episode that Daemon did not do that. Instead, he went to Dragonstone, which is that seat is supposed to be like the seat of power for the heir to the Iron Throne until they come of age. So that's technically Rhaenyra is now the princess of Dragonstone. Mm. But Daemon has gone and sort of like set up shop there. And he brought all the gold cloaks who are his, you know, cop friends from King's Landing. We haven't covered this yet. ACAB also means all gold cloaks are bastards. It's like he's like the sheriff of a new police force and he just brought all of his cops with him to mm-hmm. Dragonstone to mm-hmm. defend him and be threatening. So,
yeah. So
hence the Rogue Prince. That's our episode title. Daemon is the eponymous.
Oh, is he the Rogue titular? Prince? I couldn't. Is he the titular Rogue Prince? these are the kinds of insights we're dropping here on A Cast of Kings.
It's the titular role.
Yeah, so Rhaenyra wants to say, hey, let me go down there with my dragon. We'll solve this, you know, brother to sister. It's going to be great.
It's interesting because she suggests Dragon Riders. Right? Yeah, Uncle Tanice. She suggests Dragon Riders to help solve the crab feeder problem. This is, I think, a very important, like, tone setting moment for this episode, because again, like, you ended episode one at sort of this high point of like Rhaenyra in her gorgeous gown in front of the Iron Throne, everybody's bending the knee to her. It sort of like leaves us on a point of being like, oh cool, Rhaenyra is like really being set up to rule one day. And then we cut to this episode and she's still the cupbearer at the small council.
Terrible idea to continue to make her the cupbearer. You know?
It's been 6 months and she's still just serving drinks and being told to shut up basically in the meetings where like decisions about how to run the realm are being made. And I think that it is a good suggestion where she's like, you have people who have like me, you have dragon riders, like literally people who could wipe out an army pretty easily, as we saw when Dany attacked the Lannister army in Game of Thrones. Like, I think that she's kind of right, and Corlys is the only one who seems to want to listen to her. The fact that she gets dismissed out of hand, I think, is showing us that regardless of how much Viserys wants her, or like said that he wants her to inherit the throne, he's doing very little in real time to support her ability to rule. He's just, he's undermining her, and Otto is undermining her, and the Grand Maester undermines her. Like, everyone kind of is treating her like she's a little girl who doesn't really need to have input in this situation, which is terrible. God, it pissed me off so much when Otto's like, perhaps there's some better use for the princess's talents, Your Grace. And I'm like, oh, shut the fuck up, Otto. And then he, but then like Viserys listens to her, which is even more frustrating.
I just want to give some insight into the making of a Cast of Kings podcast. Whenever we do the show, there are incredibly intricate detailed show notes that Kim Renfro prepares. Like the gold standard of TV recap show notes is what Kim Renfro is preparing. And there's usually very little editorializing in the notes. You know, it's usually like, this is who's at the council meeting. Here's da da da. And then you have written here in the show notes, Otto interrupts her. Perhaps there's some better use for the talents, the princess talents, Your Grace. And then Kim has a little note. Oh, I hate this fucker, which is very, very rare to see. But, you know, I've registered it. And fair enough. It's like, yes, perhaps you can help pick out which one of these guys is better looking. You know, that's what you... that's what your skills are best used for. So
yeah, he sends her away from the more important conversation about decisions with rule and war and shows of force, sends her off, and then still shows up to that Kingsguard choosing and continues to undermine her in front of everyone else. And I just hate his stupid little face. He always looks all sad and concerned, and I'm like, I'm not buying it, Otto.
Not to mention, he almost got the kingdom embroiled in a war, but we'll get to that in a bit. But anyway, so then she goes and she chooses Sir Criston Cole at this night scene. I loved all the little details about this scene. She has this kind of step stool that she needs to like kind of climb on top of to look over the railing. And I love how worn that thing looked. And they showed like two close-ups of it because obviously someone put a lot of time and effort into like designing it and making sure the details look just not right. And it looked great. And the idea is like, of course, that she has used this many times before to like make similar decisions or do similar things. And so really lovely detail. And then they have this like incredibly elaborate chessboard type thing that is like showing which knight is presenting himself. That was A, awesome, but B, I'm like, did they really just build that for this purpose, or do they have this thing lying around in this event that like they need to pick a knight? You know, I don't know if that's in the books, Kim.
Probably. Maybe it's just it's probably just like meant to be like some sort of ceremonial thing anytime that a new Kingsguard
it's like
selected.
A ceremony basically, and they're like, hey, when the new knight steps forward, there's a new chess piece. So Rhaenyra chooses Sir Criston Cole, the best looking of all the knights, obviously. But that's not why she chooses.
That's a happy coincidence.
It's because he's the one that's seen the most combat experience.
And she watched him fight in the tournament. She saw him best Daemon, which I think to her, like, Daemon Targaryen's probably one of the most skilled fighters that she knows. And so if she's like, okay, this guy could even take down my uncle, it means that he's probably worthy of the seat. And I also appreciated the detail that like Sir Criston is the only one there who doesn't have a squire. He is a knight. He's been knighted, but he's common born effectively. So he doesn't have sort of like the wealth and the prestige enough to have a page or a squire holding a banner behind him. It's just him and his humble armor.
Sir Criston would be the one of the golf course carrying his own clubs. You know,
indeed.
He does not have a caddy.
Does not have a caddy.
But yeah, she chooses Sir Criston Cole, and Otto tries to undo that decision, and he fails. And, you know, Rhaenyra has a point. They need the best defending all of them. So, okay. There is a scene with Alicent and Viserys where Viserys is still working on this massive model 6 months later. And he's obviously made a lot of progress. He's talking about old Valyria, which is what the model is of. And they have this awkward conversation where he's like, you don't tell Rhaenyra about the talks we have, right? I'm doing my Kim Renfro impression of Viserys. And you kind of get a sense that their relationship is like, he is really into it because obviously she is fulfilling this geek male fantasy of, hey, this girl I'm with that spends time with me is into my esoteric and weird hobbies, you know, and oh, she actually cares about which one of these models is made out of the sandstone and such. And she actually cares about, you know, and that's why he decides to marry her at the end, I think, is because she's into his modeling stuff. No, I'm just joking. I mean, I think he clearly, it's a sign that they have at least some kind of connection, or that she is certainly better at making a connection with him than Lena, right? For a variety of reasons, but
sure.
But yeah. Any thoughts on this sequence with Alicent and Viserys?
First, I just want to make sure that anyone listening who is currently painting a tiny Warhammer or making models knows that that is a valid and lovely hobby. I'm so glad that you've taken that up. Way to go. You are nothing like Viserys. I mean, we even learn in this scene that he doesn't even build it himself. Okay. He's a faker. He's a little imposter model builder. He tells someone, he tells other stonemasons exactly what to carve. And then he just like places them there. So he's more of like a history nerd who has the ability to make someone else make a little model for him that he can then play with. So if you're out there doing real work yourself, good for you.
This reminds me of like when people say like, I built this house, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And like there's many people who are like, oh yeah, we moved to Spokane and we built this house. And it's like, okay, I believe you put in a lot of work into like designing and planning the house, but did you really build the house? Like, did you really get out a saw and a hammer and build, you know, like maybe
probably not. Did,
but most of the time when people say that, I don't think they really literally built it. And it always bothers me. Anyway,
yeah. Tangent that's what Viserys is doing for sure. Yeah. I think that this scene is so helpful specifically because of that line that you called out of, you know, there again, there's like a weird vibe going on because Alicent didn't go to his room of her own accord. She was sent there by her father. She's there now. She's very good at playing the part of like a polite, interested young lady who is like kind and supportive and encouraging. And the fact that he feels the need to make sure that she hasn't told her best friend and his daughter that they've been spending time alone together is like it's a huge red flag. It's like that means that Viserys understands that he's doing something that would upset Rhaenyra if she knew. And instead of dealing with that fact, he's hiding it until the final reveal at the end, which is why it's so devastating for everybody. So I think that the writers are doing a really good job, like scene to scene to scene. It's like we just get back to back to back examples of the way that most of the like that the men of this court are being manipulative and a little bit disregarding of Alicent and Rhaenyra's feelings, and instead they're just sort of focusing on trying to like keep themselves happy and keep their own power as siloed as possible.
There is another scene after this where Rhaenyra and Alicent meet and they have a conversation. It's a sept in this episode, but it's not the Sept of Baelor, right?
Right. So the Sept of Baelor is called such because it was named after Baelor, who, you know, designed it and had it built and everything. And he's not king yet at this point in history. So this is just a different sept. I did side by sides. They look a little bit similar in design, but they're not exactly the same. So that big sept that gets blown up in Game of Thrones by Cersei in the Wildfire, that's not this exact same building. This predates that building, but it does seem to be some sort of a worship place. We see like all of, you know, like the seven pointed star sigils. I'm guessing I didn't really get a close enough look in the episode at the statue that they're in front of, but I would guess that it's the mother who is like one of the seven gods that are worshipped by people who believe in the faith of the seven. And because they're talking about motherhood and their own mothers and praying and stuff, I'm assuming that that's sort of like the altar that they're sitting at.
Alicent and Rhaenyra share a lovely moment together where they empathize with each other about the challenges of being a girl in this situation. Rhaenyra wants people to see her as more than just a daughter, his little girl, she says. And it's nice. It kind of, given that they've covered an enormous amount of ground in these first two episodes, like an enormous amount of time period and a lot of relationships, I think that the chemistry that these two actors have with each other really sells their close relationship. and how damaging the events that occur later on must be. So
And the actors, Millie Alcock and Emily Carey, have they talked with me about this. This is another article that I can link in the show notes maybe. But they said that it is a conscious piece of their performance, that like there is a romantic undertone to their bond with each other as well. Like, yes, they are obviously like best friends, but there's like a certain amount of complexity to like teen girl friendships, especially if it's like your first friend. It's sort of like the first bond that you have outside of your family. And you can see in this scene very clearly that they are able to like speak very openly with each other, support each other, have like a tactile closeness to one another that you don't really see them have with any of the men that they interact with, even when everything seems like, you know, fine and dandy. I also think it's notable that Alicent tries to reassure Rhaenyra by saying like, he chose you for heir. And she says, he didn't choose me, he spurned Daemon. And I think that that's also an important point, that like, on the one hand, you can kind of see King Viserys's naming of Rhaenyra as heir as like, oh, way to go, feminism in Westeros, like he gets it. And then as this episode, again, I feel like I keep saying this, but like they really hammer in this episode that he is not in practice really supporting her as heir, which makes it does make it seem like he only did that to kind of teach Daemon a lesson, which is not feminism. That is something that's else not, entirely.
That's not the definition of feminism, Kim. There's a scene between Viserys, Corlys, and Rhaenys where the main conflict of the episode is presented. Corlys says, "Hey, you're seen as vulnerable right now, right? Your wife has died, your male heir has died. A lot of people, including yourself, King, don't respect Rhaenyra as the heir. And so you got to make a big move. You got to let's unite our houses, marry our daughter." And Corlys, also known as a sea snake, will have a lot of resources, financial and military resources to offer to the king. And obviously that will make Corlys and the king even closer in a way that he wants. So it's a compelling offer, as a fact that literally everyone in the episode says. Everyone in the episode reaffirms that this is a good deal. So I don't know if you have any other thoughts on that, but you know, it basically is like set up. I do want to say that the scene is beautiful. Like, it's shot out what appears to be outdoors. There's like this island and water in the background. It like looks amazing. Loving the new kind of visuals around King's Landing. Like, the production value seems very high to me. So
I thought that this was, I really like Corlys throughout this episode. I really liked him in the last episode too. I think that he's clearly one of the more just sort of like pragmatic but not cruel leaders. Like, he seems to kind of like have pretty solid political strategy most of the time. And yes, it is really skeevy that what he's proposing is him marrying his 12-year-old to a grown man. But that aside.
But it was the style at the time. It was the style at the time, Kim. So, you know,
I think that this scene does a good job of showing that like Viserys, I mean, you totally nailed it when we talked last week about how like he just cannot have difficult conversations. Right. So like in this private audience that he has with his cousin, he's very warm and friendly. And he's like, oh, Rhaenys is my favorite cousin. And oh, it's totally fine that there was some tension before, blah, blah, blah. Like, he needs people to think that he's like kind and magnanimous. But then we see that like, he mostly is just ruling by emotion. Like, he is grieving his wife, I guess. Kudos to you for still being sad 6 months later after you effectively murdered your wife. Thanks, Viserys. But like,
wow, a lot of compassion there, Kim.
I don't like these men. Like I said, Lord Corlys is like the only one so far where I'm like, I understand his perspective here, whereas Viserys just seems kind of cowardly to me, and that he can't make the difficult decision. And Corlys calls him out on that, about like, to elude a storm, you can either sail into it or around it, but you must never await its coming. And it seems like that's all Viserys does, is wait until the last possible moment when things are blowing up in his face to then take action. So
yeah,
boo Viserys. That's my take.
They're saying Bueris. Anyway, okay. So Rhaenyra and Viserys have dinner together, and you put in the show notes like an open question of does anyone outside of the room knows the choice Viserys made about Emma's death and murder? My guess would be no, because if people, specifically if Rhaenyra knew that Viserys had helped to bring about his wife's end, I don't think they would be talking, you know, like I think that was probably like a well-kept secret. And
in this dinner scene, again, it's like Viserys has a chance to be supportive of Rhaenyra again, have maybe like a heart-to-heart conversation with her. And when she kind of like tries to raise like, oh, about earlier today, you know, when I suggested the Dragon Riders, and he just cuts her off and says, oh, you're young, you'll learn, which like, ew, gross. Like you're even like in private, you can't have a direct conversation with your daughter about like, oh, okay, well, like love the input, but maybe next time wait until the rest of the small council is gone before we talk about advice or whatever. But instead he just like immediately shuts her down. And again, it's just like nonstop reinforcement that she is really kind of being hung out to dry here by everyone except Alicent.
There is a scene where Viserys gets maggot therapy for his fingers. And of course the show shows this in the most graphic way possible. His fingers' flesh is rotting. The maggots are really alive and they're squirming around everywhere. And now I actually looked this up, and maggot therapy is in fact a legitimate therapy still in use today. One thing that is great about maggots is that they seem to be really effective at doing something called debriding, where they essentially eat and destroy the necrotic tissue of a wound without affecting the live tissue. Kim, you okay over there?
No,
Kim's microphone fell a little bit. You okay?
Yeah, I'm good. Okay?
Yes. All right. These are the moments you don't hear.
About one.
Yeah, exactly. But
sorry,
you're
talking about maggot,
it.
Maggot eating?
Yes, talking about maggots. That's right. Yes, let's
great.
Just stop. You know, bumping me off the topic at hand, Kim. Please. You can watch all of our bloopers and antics over at the Cast of Kings YouTube page. By the way, castofkings.com/YouTube. Anyway. Maggots can remove necrotic tissue fairly effectively, and apparently it's like relatively safe to put your finger in one because they don't eat living tissue. So I'm not saying go do this without the aid of a doctor. I'm just saying, based on my reading, it wasn't just like some stupid thing that people of olden days did that was a bad idea. So
sure, they didn't include this in Game of Thrones, but George loves those kinds of like old and like, I don't know, bug related, insect related, maggot related healing things in the books. Roose Bolton. Right? Yeah.
I don't know what you're going to say next, so I can't confirm or deny.
I haven't heard that name in years. No, it was just that I was like, oh yeah, that is the guy's name. He's very famous for being leeched all the time. Like he's constantly having like leeches put on him and taken off. And so that,
which in my reading about maggots, I understand is still like a fairly, is sometimes used treatment as well. So.
Yeah. But so cut that has clearly like turned into this like gross wound, I'm pretty sure is the same cut that he got 6 months ago on the Iron Throne after he sent Daemon away, which as we talked about, the Iron Throne, if you're cut while seated upon the Iron Throne, it's this very symbolic kind of like thing about the seat of power rejecting you. So the fact that not only did he get cut, but then it's now turned into this like gnarly rotting flesh wound.
Yeah.
And he wears gloves. Like you can see that he has like gloves kind of like trying to cover it in other scenes. Just gross.
This scene is basically more affirmation that he should marry Lady Lena. That said, it seems pretty clear that Otto is probably doing a little bit of the old reverse psychology here. You know, he's like, oh, I mean, when my wife died, it was the absolute worst thing that could have ever happened to me, and I would never have ever dreamed about remarrying. But you should do it totally. You should do it for yourself. Yeah, no problem. You know?
Yeah.
Love the old reverse psychology, you know?
Yep. Anyway. Also, at one point, like, Viserys does, I guess, a little bit to his credit, be like, what would Rhaenyra think if I married again? And the Grand Maester says, like, what does it matter? Which, yeah, that's, like, the truest thing a man has said in this whole episode, is that what Rhaenyra thinks and feels does not matter. And that sucks.
Okay. Here's the thing that kind of bothers me about the episode, Kim, and tell me what you think of this. I just feel like Patty Considine's Viserys character feels a little bit anachronistic to me, because I think the way he's interpreting Lady Lyanna and, like, the offer to marry Lady Lyanna, he's like, oh, I would never. Someone this young, it is beyond the pale. I would never do something like, and, you know, and it's like, okay, yes, that is a very reasonable thing to think, especially with our present day knowledge, but, like, it feels like back in the day in this fictional universe that you know, on, and certainly it's based off of kind of like medieval era stuff, like, this would be a very reasonable and normal thing to do. But it feels like Viserys is kind of an audience surrogate. He's like what the audience would feel about this, as opposed to what someone in his situation would feel about this. That's kind of my read on it. What did you think?
Yeah, I think that that's fair. I guess I kind of read it as, like, he clearly wants Alicent. So, like, he's finding every reason. He keeps trying to find a reason to say no to Lena. And the fact that she's only 12, apparently, like, it's so creepy when she's like, oh, when he's like, what did your mother say? And she's like, that I don't have to bed you until I'm 14. It's like, dear God.
I mean, just the shot of him walking with Lady Lyanna, and, like, she's
so small.
It's like, oh my God, she is a child, you know, she's a baby, you know? It's done for maximum emotional impact, you know, the way it's shot, I think.
Yeah. And though they haven't disclosed to us at what stage Alicent and Rhaenyra are in their puberty and young womanhood, but, like, I'm pretty sure that 14, 15, it's like everyone's kind of tiptoeing around it, but the point is that if Viserys married Lena today, she would not be able to immediately start having children with him, whereas Alicent seems more of the childbearing teenage age, you know?
Right, right.
So I agree with you that it shouldn't be. It does maybe seem a little bit anachronistic the way that he's responding to this, but I think it plays well enough in that, like, A, yes, it is gross, and I'm glad that the writers are letting us, like, actually sit with that. As, like, I feel like in Game of Thrones, some of this was present, but it felt more like it was shown to us as, like, well, in-universe, this is just how things are done, so, like, don't be too skeeved out by it. But in House of the Dragon, they really seem to, like, be fully supportive of us, the audience, being skeeved out by the fact that all of these are, like, younger people.
The appeal of a show like this to me, though, is to see things depicted in their brutality and to kind of have the opportunity as the viewer to bring my own lens to it. I don't need the show bringing an anachronistic lens through its characters on a certain thing like this topic, you know what I mean? Let me be skeeved out. Let me bring the skeeving on my own. Like, I can sure. already be. I don't need Viserys to be skeeved out by it. I can be skeeved out by it. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's kind of my position on a show like this. But anyway,
yeah.
I just want to bring my own skeeving. Really, is what it is, Kim. You know,
totally so, fair.
Yeah. Okay. They talk and. Lena is like, yeah, I will produce many heirs, and she says all the right things, and he's like, okay, so did your dad tell you to say that? And she kind of gives it away, and I'm like, Lena, you're blowing this, you're messing this whole thing up.
your rehearsal you're should have been a little more natural. No,
yeah,
I mean, yeah, it's pretty plain. Also, I just wanted to note too that I love that they brought up the dragons again in this scene, to have, like, Lena be, like, really interested in the fact that Viserys was the last person to ride Balerion the Black Dread, who's like the giant dragon. That's the skull that they were standing in front of in episode one, for, like, that big prophecy scene. That dragon in the books, Viserys was like 16 years old when it says that he entered the dragon pit, which is where Balerion was being kept at the time, and did manage to like get onto his back, which is a feat. Like, you know, like not every Targaryen has the ability to be able to ride a dragon like that. But it says that like basically like he only flew for like a short amount of time, and that Viserys felt like the dragon was basically like too old and kind of like dragging a little bit, and that was the last time that anybody ever rode him. And then Balerion died like a year later. So I kind of get, they don't really say this explicitly in the books or in the show yet, but you kind of get the impression that Viserys is like a little bit afraid of like riding a dragon again. Mm-hmm. Like he's the king. It probably wouldn't be hard for him to like find another dragon to bond to, but he hasn't. And like Lena's kind of like all excited about the idea that he was the last one to ride Balerion, and Viserys is just kind of like, oh yeah, well, that was that. And I'm like,
dragons, they're the ponies of Westeros, you know? Anyway, there's a scene between Rhaenyra and
Rhaenys,
right? So again, to reestablish, Rhaenyra is obviously the daughter of Viserys the king. Rhaenys is
the king's cousin?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. She was a granddaughter.
The granddaughter of
Old King Jaehaerys.
Jaehaerys, who we saw in the very first scene of the series.
Yes.
And she was passed over to be queen.
Yes.
And they have a neat, it's a great chat because it shows like, hey, all is not well in the family. There's tension. Mm-hmm. And she basically says that these men would rather burn this kingdom to the ground than see a woman as the ruler. Which strikes me as pretty, not a reasonable position, but certainly a very accurate one based on what we've seen in the show, right?
Yeah, and she really lays out basically like the order of operations from the point, from assuming that Viserys is going to remarry, which we learn at the end of the episode he has every intention to, which is that as soon as he has another direct male heir, that will be Rhaenyra's half-brother. Rhaenys is just like, as soon as he does actually produce a true-born male heir, your claim to the Iron Throne will not be taken seriously anymore by a vast majority of the people who should support you.
Yeah, you're just a backup. You're kind of a backup heir. You're the understudy to the true heir, basically, you know?
Yeah, so. And Rhaenyra kind of tries to say like, well, when I'm queen, I'll make a new order. And it's big Dany saying big, she's going to break the wheel. Big Dany vibes. Hope,
and we all know how well that went.
I loved this conversation.
Loved it. Loved it. Loved the tension, you know, and it obviously has some very unfortunate resonances with our society today that you and I are living in. So anyway.
Yeah.
People wanting to burn the whole thing to the ground rather than elect a woman. I've never heard of such a thing. Anyway.
Yeah. And Rhaenys, I think.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I just keep going on tangents. But I was going to say, I mentioned this in our Twitter Spaces chat last night, but I talked with Eve Best, who plays Rhaenys, before the season started at a roundtable interview. And she said that she thinks of Rhaenys as kind of being like Hillary Clinton, of like a potential candidate for power who is passed over and then has to like remain in the political spotlight and just kind of like grin and bear it through understanding that she was not chosen. So fun fact from the actress who plays Rhaenys there.
We get a little bit more, a few more scenes with Viserys and Alicent. He's literally telling everyone about his plan to potentially remarry. And she's like, I'm sure that's going to be great. You know, she's going to love spending time with you just like me, you know?
I'm like, was Viserys like hoping that she, right? Like, was he hoping that she would be like, no, please don't stop. Choose her. I'm don't right go. Here. Don't I go. Love you. Yeah, no. Instead, she is literally like making her fingers bleed under the table because she is clearly so uncomfortable in this continued position that she's been put in of like, she knows all the right things to say. She's very supportive. Like, I love that she does and says all the right things. That a person who's having a hard time making a decision would want to hear. She's very encouraging. She's very reassuring. And yet we know that she is like literally harming herself, like behind, yeah, behind, outside of Viserys's view, because this isn't her preferred lunchtime partner, I would guess.
When we did a Twitter space last night, I was thinking to myself that I think Alicent is fairly inscrutable. We don't really get a sense of how she experiences it. I've revised that position. I think the scene that really unlocks it for me is when she talks to Otto, right? And
yeah,
he says, "Are you going to go see Viserys?" And she says, "If you wish it." And she says, yeah, it in a way that makes me feel like she would only do it if he wishes it. Like she's not right. going there of her own volition, right?
Right.
And even though you don't really see her struggle with that other than picking her fingernails, that was the scene that I'm like, okay, if I go back and rethink of that scene, she's clearly not super happy with any of this, but she's playing the part. And I think yeah. that's a very fine line to walk, right? She's doing all the right things. She's being encouraging. She's being nice and everything, but she's also not happy with it. And kind of that's,
yeah.
that's ultimately where I think that character lands for this. So anyway.
Yeah, totally.
It comes out that Daemon has snuck in, stolen a little dragon egg out of the dragon keepers.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, how did you steal an egg? How did the, you know, Daemon Ocean's 11 a dragon egg from under 50 dragon keepers? And somebody says,
they don't really
it's
tell
Daemon. he's like, it's Daemon. He left a note as though like that explains it. Oh, it's Daemon. That's how he was able to, you know, and maybe like Daemon pulled rank. You know, or maybe he had his gold cloaks with him. So, you know, it's not the worst
sure.
explanation. But
and he anyway. Is a dragon rider. So, like, he wouldn't fear entering that space in the way that, like, a normal person would.
Yeah.
Right?
It comes out that the egg that was taken was for a dragon called Dreamfire, which was the one that was chosen for Prince Balon, who is now deceased. This is the thing that Rhaenyra cares the most about. She's very upset by the fact that it's Dreamfire's egg.
Mm-hmm.
So they're like, we got to go on an away mission. And King Viserys is like, I'm going to go myself. And Otto, actually the only, literally the smartest freaking thing he does this episode is say, don't go. It's too dangerous. Which is like the only piece of good advice he has this episode.
Yeah.
And so Otto goes instead. So they go and meet in Dragonstone because Prince Daemon has now not only occupying Dragonstone illegally, but he has stolen an egg, which is obviously going to grow up to be very powerful. And it is an egg that has a lot of emotional meaning to the other Targaryens in the show. And so it's mm-hmm. like, okay, this, he has gone too far now. He has gone too far.
Yeah. It's like he's been throwing a little tantrum over on Dragonstone and like really wanted to get Viserys' attention. And I think yeah. knew that going and stealing Balon's egg would finally get some sort of like in-person response from his brother.
They have a big confrontation at Dragonstone. We see, again, the updated Dragonstone. We already talked about how amazing it looks, but I just loved like everything about the scene, production-wise, spectacular looking.
Also a tiny note about like, oh yeah, go ahead.
No, you go, please.
I was going to say, I love, obviously with Game of Thrones, the idea of like, characters teleporting was brought up a lot, like the fact that they would be like very far away from their next location and then like magically appear there, which this is television, people, it's fine. But I just love that they show Otto like preparing to leave the castle at what seems to be like dark of night to me, and then it's like sunrise at Dragonstone when the ship is there. And I just love the choice of that because it makes the lighting so beautiful. I loved like the ocean fog that's kind of like hanging over the castle, and like the idea that Otto, you know, sailed through the night to get to Dragonstone as soon as possible. And it's now dawn when they're all meeting.
Yeah. They have a very tense confrontation. And I'm going to say, I don't think Otto acquits himself particularly well. He is really inflamed. Otto needs a lesson in de-escalation tactics. He is really inflaming yeah. things, right? He is
yeah.
saying like, you're here with your whore and this is an insult to the king. And he's not de-escalating, right? He is.
No.
I'm like, are you literally trying to get everyone killed? You know, like, is that
yeah.
the goal? Because he didn't even go there with a dragon. That's the thing. Is like, the whole time I was wondering, why didn't they bring a dragon? And I think
the
answer is because Otto was like, Daemon would not dare kill me, because if he killed me, he'd be basically dooming himself. Yes, he would, but he wouldn't be dooming himself that day unless you had a dragon with you. You know what I'm saying? And so the idea that there's no, that he's going in there and just kind of insulting Damon and his his
and Damon betrothed. Just does not care. I love that you picked that audio clip at this episode, because he's like, you've been starting a war, and Damon going, wonderful. And
yes. Amazing. Like, love it.
Exactly. Love what he wants. Like, you're not winning any arguments here, Otto. Yeah, also, I love Damon calling Kristen Cole Sir Crispin.
And they Sir have Crispin, a little Kristen, Kristen Cole can throw hands as well, right? He's like, oh yeah, I remember me knocking you off your horse. And it's like, dude, Kristen, you're inflaming things too. None of you know what you're doing here.
No.
Anyway.
No.
So then Rhaenyra, the only person, the smartest person, shows up with the dragon. The entrance is amazing. You see the clouds like part a little bit. It's totally badass. And I love her like whole dragon getup too. It just is, it reminds you of like Dany's Targaryen
totally,
you know, that dragon riding
like
getup.
Black and gray.
Yeah, very black, very scaly, and it looks really badass. So
yeah.
Love all of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then she comes in, intervenes, saves Otto's ass. And
totally.
He's like, hey, why don't you just kill me now? Let's get it over with. And he doesn't, because why is that? Why don't you think he killed? Well, obviously it would mean certain death for him at that time, right? But
true. And I think that he genuinely likes Rhaenyra. Like, I think that this scene does a good job of showing that like the Targaryens kind of have their own inner circle of dynamics and cultural practices and importance. Like, again, the fact that they're speaking High Valyrian to each other, Otto can't understand the conversation that they're having with one another, really. And you see how that bothers him, that he cannot control Rhaenyra in this situation because she actually has the upper hand, because she has an existing positive relationship with her uncle. She knows.
And also a dragon.
And also a huge dragon. It's incredible. And I think that this scene does a lot of good work in proving that her previous suggestion of using dragon riders when needed is correct, that like she has good instincts.
Mutually assured destruction is a very logical geopolitical strategy, I think, is really what this show's position is. So
yeah,
he gives back the egg, does not surrender Dragonstone though, but gives back the egg, and then has a little scene with Missaria where she's pissed because what Damon has done is claim that they're getting married and she is pregnant with his child. He has claimed that. And then Rhaenyra is like, her pregnant? And it's clear that she's not pregnant, at least at this point. And she gets really upset because she doesn't even know about this machination.
Yeah.
And she gives this whole speech where she says that the reason she wanted to be with Damon was safety, which, first of all, really got a question of judgment there, Missaria. Like, did this strike you as the most balanced, calm individual? But also reasonable point to not want to be lied about the state of your womb. She kind of implies that she is sterile or has been sterilized, right? I don't know if you caught that or if I misinterpreted that. She said,
maybe she
made sure I would never be threatened by childbirth, is what she says. Now, I don't know if she's speaking biologically or if she's speaking in some other capacity, but I interpreted that as her saying, like, I literally can't have children. I don't know if that's true or not. But
and I kind of understand, like, her point of, like, you're putting me at risk because, like, I would basically be hunted for I could have an assassin sent after me by, like, the king's men or something. Weird dynamic that they're setting up there for sure.
Speaking of weird things, Missaria's accent. Bizarre and incomprehensible, I think. And I don't know if we need to go too much into it, but we had a lot of people guessing as to what the accent might be. Some people heard Jamaican, some people heard French, some people heard Spanish.
Chinese and French, I think someone suggested or something. I don't know. They also had her in the books. She's from Lys, which is a city in Essos. And in this little, in part of her monologue, she says that like she's been sold and moved so many times that she can't even remember her homeland anymore. So like, I guess it makes sense if it's a little bit of like a melting combo of accents. But yeah, I found myself confused by the choice because it stands out in a way that I don't think it should. Like, I think that there was probably, in my opinion, a way to give her some accent that like still places her within solid context. And instead it's right. like, it's hard to understand. And I, at this point would, I think rather that Sonoya Mizuno was just speaking in her own British accent.
Yeah. Maybe they'll change, you know, it's not unheard of for characters to change accent when they realize that it doesn't work, you know? And so hopefully they do that. But I felt very bad for Sonoya Mizuno. I was like, you know, I feel like the showrunners kind of hung her out to dry because it's a terrible accent. It's nearly incomprehensible. And she's the one that has to kind of bear the brunt of criticism for it, even though it's not her decision. So she's a great actor and deserves better than the accent that she's been given. So,
yeah.
Okay. Rhaenyra and Viserys have a big confrontation over the fact that she violated his orders and endangered herself. And he says, "You're my only heir, even though I haven't been treating you that way at all." And they have a kind of heart to heart where he's like, "Hey, if I did get married, like, would you be cool with it?" And she's like, "Of course, I completely understand any decision you would ever make unless you're doing something so ridiculous." And I'm just throwing this out there as an example, as such as marrying my friend, you know, like if you did anything other than that, it'd be totally understandable.
Yeah. No.
Anyway.
Yeah, if only she had thought to add in that caveat to her approval for his desire to marry.
Then he would have been like, oh, so that would bother you. Oh, okay.
That man knew what he was doing. He says, "I do not wish to make us estranged." Well, broski, your actions kind of tell a different story there, because what the heck did you think was going to happen? Yeah.
There is
also
a scene
that
with...
He calls Rhaenyra. He's like, "Oh, I forget sometimes that you're a woman grown." And I'm like, very convenient of you to think of your 14 or 15-year-old daughter as a grown woman because you're about to marry her peer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Way to go.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, like earlier in the episode, he says like, "Oh, don't worry, you're young. You'll learn." It's like these men pick and choose when they want to treat teenage girls as women, depending on how politically advantageous it would be to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I hate that. Mm-hmm. So more booze for Viserys.
Viserys has a small council meeting, aka the awarding of the rose, at the Bachelor Westeros edition. And they have this big conversation where he's like, "I've decided to take a new wife." And like the way it's edited is just straight out of a reality TV show. Is like, "I choose," and then you cut to like every single person's face in the room. Uh-huh. "I choose Alicent Hightower." And it's like, and then be shocked. "I'm not here to make friends, but ... you know, whatever. Anyway, so yeah, Alicent wins the rose, and Otto has this amazing moment where he flashes this smile at Corlys that's like the most dickish smile imaginable.
He's so skeevy.
Yeah.
I hate it.
Corlys is pissed. He is not happy that his offer has been spurned. And Rhaenyra is upset.
I would say Rhaenyra and Alicent are upset.
But it's true, and I think Alicent is very good at controlling her emotions, right, in public.
Yeah.
But yes, Alicent, I guess, also not feeling great about it. And Rhaenyra storms out of the room, and Viserys is like, "What? You were bothered that your best friend's now about to become your stepmom? He cannot fathom such a thing. He cannot fathom being bothered." So anyway.
Also, like, not only because, again, like, Rhaenys made this point very clear to Rhaenyra before. It's like, it's not just, okay, you've now taken my best friend and made her my stepmom, but like, you've taken my best friend and made her my stepmom with the intention of getting her pregnant as soon as possible. And
right. And usurping my place as the rightful heir, basically.
Usurping her place, but putting her in danger. Like, Rhaenyra is still grieving the death of her mother who just died in childbirth. Like, now her best friend's going to be up for the little spin the wheel and see if this pregnancy kills you game. Like, that's terrible. It's terrible on all accounts. I truly felt Rhaenyra's heartbreak in that moment. I think that they did a really good job of making us understand how devastating that's going to feel to her.
Agreed. Final scene. Corlys is talking with someone, a mysterious person. There's a really lovely shot of this skull with barnacles on it, right? Like a statue of it barnacles looked, on it.
Yeah, it kind of reminded me of like a statue that would have been dug up after like the fall of Rome or something, that like had been on the seafloor and is like covered in barnacles now and is now like a decorative art piece in the room. Love that. And like a little skull with like a bunch of teeth that I don't know if it was supposed to be a dragon skull or some other creature skull. Very cool.
Yeah, yeah. I do love that this show seems to be taking a lot of time to reflect on the contributions of the craftspeople who are making all the set design stuff, right?
Like, yeah.
That step stool earlier today, like close-up shot of this statue with barnacles. You know, it's like, it's really dwelling on these things in a way that most shows don't. Most shows would just be like, hey, it's in the background, it's part of the atmosphere, but like someone freaking spent hours like applying plastic barnacles to this statue, and it's like the show is honoring that, and so I like that.
Yeah, it's a great tone setting choice, I think, for all the various locations. It makes the world feel very lived in.
So Corlys talks about how he worked himself up from nothing, and he kind of explains that he and Damon, we've always been underestimated. We're self-made men, you and me. Let's ally ourselves. There's a great line where Damon says something along the lines of, it was never my brother's strongest trait. And Corlys says, what? Being king? Ooh, Viserys slam.
Boom, roasted.
and Corlys is like, hey, we gotta join forces because, hey, Damon, you know, I think you have a really good claim to the throne. And also, I need this crab feeder dealt with, right?
Yeah.
And that's primarily why Corlys is coming to Damon. Like, maybe Damon can help deal with the crab feeder situation, right?
Yeah. And just continue to strengthen his position, I think, by having allies. I think Corlys knows that his house's strength depends on being respected and allied with other people. And since Viserys clearly just like gave him the big middle finger, he goes to find the next best thing, which is Damon. I also love that. I love how like Corlys kind of starts shit talking, and then Damon's like, I will speak about my brother how I want. You will not. And sort of like sets up a boundary of like, yeah, I understand that we're about to both be working together against my brother. However, I get to do it for petty reasons and you don't. Like,
I may end up, in fact, murdering my brother. I, David Chen, don't know whether that happens or not, but like, I may end up killing him, but you will not speak ill of him in my presence.
Yeah.
Fair enough. I think something you talked about earlier with like the character speaking of Valyrian is there's an in-group and an out-group, right? And if you're in the Targaryen family, you know, you are in this in-group, and everyone else, F off, you know, don't come near us. So
yeah, everyone else is at the mercy of how the Targaryens are feeling at any point. It's great.
Any other thoughts on season one, episode two of House of the Dragon, Kim Renfro?
The last thing, I guess, the last like little detail, we see like a shot of the crab feeder at the very end there, and it looks like he has grayscale, which is recognizable from in Game of Thrones when Ser Jorah had it, like that sort of like patchy wound looking thing all over his like face and mask. Gnarly. So yeah, get ready for more crab feeder in your life. Really bookended this episode.
I'm psyched. Yeah, I think they probably shot all that crab feeder stuff at the same time, right?
And sure. Then
it's interesting, you know, they take all that footage with a lot of different angles and they sprinkle it throughout the episode, and it kind of gives it this nice feel. So it's a cool editing decision, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So overall, solid episode, some ups, some downs. Kim Renfro loved it. I liked it a lot. Those are our thoughts here on A Cast of Kings. You can find more episodes of this podcast at acastofkings.com. Email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. Support this podcast by becoming a member of decodingtv.com, where you can get ad-free episodes and exclusive bonus episodes that Kim Renfro and I are recording for that audience. And find us online also at YouTube at acastofkings.com/YouTube and TikTok at acastofkings.com/TikTok. Until next week, we'll be back later with another recap of House of the Dragon.
Bye.